Good evening, you all. My name is Harold, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Harold.
And it's by the grace of God and the fellowship I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, it hadn't been necessary for me to have a drink of alcohol since February 1970. I take no credit for that. I had the extraordinary good fortune to walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat down. I took advantage of everything that was being given away. Now, my home group is the Monday Night Back to Basics group in Annapolis, Maryland, which everyone knows is the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't tell you how pleased I am to be here. I had the extraordinary privilege of being a speaker at a 2010 International in San Antonio. And that was a tremendous experience. But I've been here for 5 days now, and I looked around this room, and the enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous among this group is just extraordinary. You ought to give yourself a hand around here. The speakers have just been outstanding. I mean, starting on Sunday night with Ruth, and then my good friend Sterling stepping up on Monday, and then Doug, Carla, my very good friend Maria, who's helped me understand her and her girlfriend how to understand my watch. I got a brand new watch, and brand new phone, and I can't figure it out. They've been helping me figure it out. It's incredible. I learned a long time ago the power's in our experience. The power's in our collective, in our individual experience, and that experience are in these rooms. If I have an idea and you have an idea, we each have one idea. But if I give you my idea and you give me your idea, we have two ideas. And I think that Bill Wilson had that in mind. They said Bill Wilson, they called Bill Wilson a stock broker. Bill Wilson was a stock speculator. Bill used to sell fast talking to slow thinking people is what Bill Wilson did. But God gave Bill a special gift. He gave Bill an insight. He allowed Bill to be able to look down the road and see what was coming. And he gave us three legacies. Three legacies that we can stand on today forever. And I think that that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We live a day at a time, but our principles will last forever. I remember Ruth mentioning one of my favorite pamphlets, A Member's Eye View of AA. And one of the things that it's required reading for all my pigeons. One of the things he says is that nothing that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is new. The principles that we share in Alcoholics Anonymous are as old as time itself. The reason they work are because they're true. They are true principles, and they will work for anyone. Best example of that, there's over 312-step programs that use our principles. So Alcoholics Anonymous is an extraordinary thing. I like to think of AA as a giant tapestry. If you ever look at a tapestry, on one side of it is a beautiful picture. But if you look behind it, you see 1,000 threads going in 1,000 different directions. And if you pull a thread over here, the picture will change over here. You pull a thread over here, the picture will change over here. And all those thousands of threads are the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, trudging that happy road. We're like a mosaic in progress. And I think that Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember reading years ago a New Age writer named Aldous Huxley wrote an article. And in the article he said that Alcoholics Anonymous was the greatest social movement of the 20th century. And like most smart-ass pigeons, I went to my sponsor and I said, what do you mean by that? And he said that Huxley wasn't saying that Alcoholics Anonymous were elitists. What he's saying that God always seemed to choose the least of them to show the others the way. And he picked the alcoholic, truly, the least of them. And he showed them, gave them an extraordinary gift, the ability to talk to another alcoholic and have them hear what we say. Look at the disciples of Jesus. They were all common people. They were fishermen. They were shepherds. They were liars and thieves and prostitutes. Who's an AA? God chose the least of them, and he gave us this gift. We can talk to another alcoholic and have them hear what we say. And so we have a special challenge here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill Wilson once said, no one invented Alcoholics Anonymous. He believes that Alcoholics Anonymous started way back, 1932, over in Zurich. One of the foremost renowned psychiatrists in the world, Dr. Carl Jung, was treating a New York businessman named Roland Hazard. Treated him for a whole year. And he thought he had really solved his problem. He came back to New York, and within 6 months, he was drunk. He went back to see Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung, my experience, the really, really great men and women are very humble people. And Dr. Jung told him, I've given you all my art, all my skills. There's nothing I can do for you. And Roland was devastated, and he said, is there nothing you can do? And Dr. Jung said, now and then, once in a while, an alcoholic of your type has a spiritual experience, and his whole life changes. Well, Roland came back to New York. There were a group of folk down in the Lower East Side, Calvary Mission, a really prominent minister, Silkworth, had started a mission down in Trinity Church. And Roland went to the mission, and he met up with some people. They were known as the Oxford Groups. And the Oxford Groups had some very simple, very primary principles. Honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. They call them the absolutes. Well, Roland started to practice these absolutes in his life, and he stopped drinking. And Roland remembered a friend of his that he knew up in Vermont. His name was Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby was a real winner. Ebby, last time they had heard from Ebby, Ebby had stolen somebody's car and driven it into a farmhouse, got out the car and asked the farmer's wife for a cup of coffee. They were going to put Ebby away forever. But Roland and some other folk went up there. Actually, Ebby Thatcher, they were very prominent people. His father was the mayor of Albany and once ran for vice president. They were very prominent people. Actually, the judge they went before was a relative of Ebby. And they let Ebby go, come back to New York with Roland, took him to the Oxford Groups, and Ebby got sober. Then Ebby remembered a guy he used to know, a guy named Bill Wilson. Hadn't seen him for a while. And he had heard that Bill was having some trouble. And so he called him up. And Bill was living over on Clinton Street in Brooklyn and answered the phone, and Ebby asked if he could come over and see him. And Bill was kind of glad. He hadn't seen Ebby for a while. He had drank with them. They had hung out and done some pretty strange things together. Well, Ebby came to Bill's house. He sat at the kitchen table, and Bill pushed a bottle of gin across the table to Ebby, and he said, I'm not drinking today. And Bill said, well, What are you, on the water wagon? And Nebi said, no, I got religion. Well, that really shook him up. He said, what brand of religion did you get? Well, Nebi said, it isn't exactly a religion. I met up with some folk and they gave me some simple ideas and I don't have to drink anymore. And Bill was polite and he asked them what they were. And he told them, you get honest with yourself. You talk it out with another person. You make restitution to people that you may have harmed. And you pray to whatever God you might know. And he left. Well, not long after that, Bill wound up in town's hospital again, not knowing it was for the last time. An old Doc Silk worker was standing on the steps. And as Bill was walking up the steps, he said, Doc, this time I got something. This time I really got something. He was waving a bottle of gin at the time. Old Doc said, you better go on upstairs and lay down. Well, later that evening, Ebby came to see Bill again, and he didn't pontificate or preach. In fact, he waited until Bill asked him, what was that neat little formula you don't have to drink anymore? And Ebby told him, you get honest with yourself. You talk it out with another person. Make restitution to people that you may have harmed, and you pray to whatever God you might know. And he left. Well, that night, Bill was in his room, and Bill didn't have any formal religion. His family were agnostics. They practiced something called Swedborgning from Sweden, where they originally were from. But that night, Bill came to a point he talks about. He said, sometimes you have to go down to the depths of despair and hopelessness before you can hear the message. And he was at that point. And he was in his darkened room, and he cried out, if there's a God, will you show yourself? And all of you know that's in our book. It was a blinding flash, and the wind was blowing. It felt like he was on a mountaintop. And he said, this must be the God of the preachers. Well, old Doc Silkworth came in. and Bill told him what happened. And Doc said, wasn't surprised. He said, something very profound has happened to you. And if I was you, I'd hold on to it because it's a lot better than what you had. Well, from that very simple meeting, Bill went out. And for some strange insight that he had, he knew helping other alcoholics was the best thing for him. And he found himself one day with a handful of proxy votes. And he was going out to Akron to exercise these proxy votes, to vote these votes and take over Tool and Die Company. And he got out to Akron, and somebody had more votes than him, and he lost the proxy vote. And he was kind of disappointed, and he was in a Mayfair hotel, and he's walking up and down. On one end of the hotel was a gin mill. On the other end, there was a church directory. He had $10 in his pocket. And he walked down the hall and he looked up at the directory. And he went down the list and he came across a name, Reverend Walter Tunks. And he called him up, not knowing that Reverend Tunks was a member of the Oxford Group. Also, it was a little strange. Normally, somebody call you up and say, I'm a rum-dum from New York and I need another alcoholic to talk to, they'll hang up or call the police. But he didn't. He gave him a number of names. And the last name on the list was a woman named Henrietta Seibeling. Henrietta family, the Seibeling family, was very prominent in Akron. John Seibeling was a congressman. And he called up, and Henry and Bill, when he got Henry on the line, he said, my name is Bill Wilson, and I need another alcoholic to talk to. And Henrietta said, our prayers have been answered. Bill not knowing that for years, Dr. Bob Smith had been going to Oxford group meetings. Never acknowledged that he had a drinking problem. A week before Bill Wilson came to Akron, Dr. Bob went to his Oxford group and said, I can't stop drinking, I'm an alcoholic. And somebody said, Would you like us to pray for you? He said, yes. I'd like you to pray for him. A week later, Bill Wilson shows up in Akron. Says, I'm a rum-dum from New York. I need another alcoholic to talk to. I'm going to commit some heresy here. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous began in Bill Wilson's kitchen. We know the structure for AA began in Akron. But when Ebby came to see Bill, for the first time in any recorded history, the problem and the solution came together. Dr. Young knew what the problem was, but had no idea what the solution was. Dr. Silkworth knew what the solution was, had no idea what the problem was. The Oxford group didn't know there was a problem or that they had the solution. It wasn't until Bill and Ebby came together that the problem and the solution finally came together. Not only that, he brought them a simple program of action. And I believe Alcoholics Anonymous began in Bill Wilson's kitchen. Now, when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any idea of that. None whatsoever. I grew up on the east side of Manhattan. I grew up in a section of New York called Spanish Harlem. Now, you grow up in Spanish Harlem, you grow up very quickly. Or you might not grow up at all. See, by today's standards, they would probably consider me an entrepreneur. In those days, I was a hustler. I used to find stuff before it officially got lost. Yeah. If it was small enough, I just stole it. If it was too big to carry, I lay down next to it and claimed it. We moved up to the South Bronx. It was like kind of jumping out of the fire pan into the fire. And we lived in the South Bronx for many years. I was talking to Sterling about that because we come out of the same neighborhood. That's kind of strange. You see two of us come out of the same neighborhood and wind up in Crescent Butte. Could you believe that? So I never will forget. Growing up in the streets of New York, everybody drank. People didn't trust you if you didn't drink. Everybody drank, and people got drunk, and people fell down on the street. Nobody really thought much about it. And that was the way it was in New York. Everybody drank. And so drinking was part of the culture. Nobody really thought there was anything wrong with it. Nobody really knew the term alcoholism. We called people drunks or boozers or whatever. And that was the way it was. My father was an alcoholic. I didn't know he was an alcoholic. He was a beautiful man. He taught me to read. He taught me to read Dostoevsky. He taught me to read the Rubaiyats of Omar Khayyam and the Prophet, Khalil Gibran. I wrote those when I was a little kid. But then he'd go out and drink, and he'd come back, and he'd scream and holler and throw things. The kids would all run. And nobody knew what was wrong with him. I didn't until I came in here. And so we had to do whatever we had to do to survive in the street because there wasn't any real money around. And so I did. I went out and I could make money. I was a kid, but I could make money. If you're a kid in New York, you can make money all kinds of ways. And so I did. And I learned a lot by running around in the streets. And I learned, one of the things I learned was never trust anybody. Don't trust anybody. You know, people will fool you. They will put you into places where you can't get out. The other thing I think that helped me an awful lot as a little kid, I was a scrawny little kid. I was, you know, about half, not even, I weighed about 60 pounds up until the time I was about 10. But I was mean. People, other kids would think I was a target. And they would try to take my lunch money or whatever. They only did it once because I would kick and bite and scratch. Mike Tyson didn't have nothing on me. They would see me coming down the street and they say, leave that kid alone. He'll sneak up behind you with a brick. And I think that's what happens to us. We become, people call alcoholics loners. And we're not. We're not really loners. We're very private people, necessarily so. We're very private people. We put this wall out here. And anytime somebody would try to put a, find out a little bit about us, we'd put a brick in that wall. Somebody tried to get to know us, learn a little bit about us, we put another brick in that wall. And pretty soon that wall got higher and higher and higher. And one day, I looked around, and I realized nobody could get to me because of the wall. But I was behind the wall, and I couldn't get out. I used to run into that wall 14 times a day. Hit that wall, bam, bam, till I realized I could go around the wall. My old sponsor used to tell this story, and I know everybody in here has heard it. It's about 100 years old, but I like the way I tell it, so I'm going to tell it. There's two doors at the end of a hallway. This is how you can tell the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. There's two doorways at the end of a hallway. Over one door, there's a sign and it says, peace and happiness. Inside the other door is a guy with a baseball bat. Now, the non-alcoholic walks down the hallway, sees the two doors, walks through the door where the guy with the bat is, hits him right in the head, turns around, goes across the hall, walks through the door and has peace and happiness for the rest of his life. The alcoholic walks down the hallway, sees the same two doors, walks right through the door, and there's the guy with the bat, hits him right in the head. Turns around, comes back down the hallway, goes right back up the hallway, same two doors, goes right through the door, the guy with the bat's in there, hits him right in the head again. Turns around, comes back down the hallway, turns around, goes right back up the hallway, but this time he stops. And he says, maybe he won't be in there this time. Maybe I can get away with it. So he goes through the door where the guy with the bat was, and the guy's gone. And the alcoholic goes looking for him. That was me. Hitting that brick wall 14 times a day. They were drafting people back in the early 50s, and the Korean War had just broken out. And I did not want to go in the military, did not want to go in the Army whatsoever. So I did the cool, really slick thing. I joined the National Guard. I joined the National Guard, and I joined probably the oldest black military organization in those days there was, the old 369, 369 Artillery. The 369 were originally the 9th Cavalry, 9th Cavalry, the old Buffalo soldiers. They had ridden up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt in the Spanish-American War. Well, I met guys that had been drinking since they rode up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt. Old-time regular army. And if I had to pinpoint where my drinking really began and took off, it would have been there. Well, I was very good in high school. I had gone to a technical high school, and I knew electronics and electrical technology. And so when I got in the military, they sent me to school. As a matter of fact, I went to guided missile schools almost the entire time my unit was on active duty. And the thing of it is that drinking was part of my culture then. And it continued. I would drink sometimes. We would be sitting around drinking, and you'd drink till you fell down, or till the cops came, or the place caught on fire, or something would happen to interfere with your drinking. And that's the way I drank. And I got in the military, I drank the same way. Well, what they did was they sent me down in Texas. El Paso, Texas, down to Fort Bliss. I was stationed down to Fort Bliss, and And everybody knows that's right on the border of Juarez. And back in those days, you could walk across the bridge into Juarez, and they had a drink called Oso Negro Gin, Black Bear Gin. I never will forget it, 44 cent a quart. Buddy and I were wandering down the streets of Juarez, breaking gin bottles on the lampposts, which the Mexican police take a very dim view of. And I wound up in a Mexican jail. When I was a little kid, we'd go to the movies, and we see these Errol Flynn movies, and Errol Flynn would be a pirate, and they'd be sword fighting on the pirate ship and going on, and then they'd catch him and throw him in the dungeons. And you see these big blocks of wood that they put people on and hang people on the wall. I thought that was make-believe till I got in a Mexican jail. Thing of it is, I was boxing. I was boxing, and my CO was a fight fan. And he came and he got me out. And I think that's really the dilemma of the alcoholic. We get in some of the damnedest things, and somehow we manage to get out. I was in a jail once, and they asked me to leave. They asked me to leave. Little town, upstate New York, sitting on the curb, sucking out a wine bottle. Police came by, said, get in. Took me to their jail, brand new jail. They put me in the cell, I laid down, lit a cigarette, fell asleep, and the mattress caught on fire. Took me out, put me across the hall in another cell, lit a cigarette, fell asleep, the mattress caught on fire. Guy came in there and said, you have to leave. And they put me out. Fact is, I really didn't want to go. It never occurred to me how bizarre that was. And I think that that's the real dilemma, the dilemma of the alcoholic. We never see ourselves the way we are. Other people see us clearly. And we go down the road, and we go down that highway, and we never look back. The warning signs are there all along the way, but we can't see them. We have a cloud. We have a disease that says there's nothing wrong with you. Clancy says we have a disease of perception. We can't see what's wrong with us. And I think that as we go down that road, the cloud gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and we never see it until it's too late. And we either die or wind up in jail. And so I got out of that again. And then what happened was, about that same time, the unit came off active duty. And the unit came off active duty, and I went back to the South Bronx. And I had a lot of good skills coming out of the military. I was a commissioned officer. I'm probably one of the few people that know how to arm a barometric fuse for a hydrogen warhead. They taught me how to do that. I often wonder what would happen if I was sitting at a console drunk one day, hit the wrong button. None of us would be in here. So I got out the military, the unit got deactivated, came back to the South Bronx, and there didn't seem to be a big demand for people that knew how to arm barometric fuses. So I took a test, and I'm a good test taker. And I wound up on the New York City Police Department. Now, I went through the academy, came out the academy in 60, and they put me right back in the same community that I grew up in. They put me right back in Central Harlem. I knew every dope dealer, every prostitute, every numbers. I could walk into any gin mill, any bar, anywhere, and drink till I fell down. And people would cover for you. You'd always get covered for you. I remember I locked a guy up for being drunk once. And when time called to court, they had to carry me inside. About the same time, I decided to get married. And the reason I got married was my brother got married. And I married a beautiful woman, a beautiful man, a beautiful person. And she became my greatest enabler. And we were moving along as well as we could. I had a job, and we had two small children. But I was an alcoholic, and I didn't really want to be married. I wanted to be out on the corner with the guys having a good time. I wanted this sense of responsibility, but I had no responsibility. And so I just continued to drink and drink and drink. The things that happened, the things that would happen to me, or the same thing that happened to everybody else, I got into trouble. And I think that the alcoholic that gets into trouble, and the more he drank, the more trouble he gets into, the never really realizes that what's happening to him is beyond his control, that he can't stop. And subconsciously, we really want to stop, but we can't. We don't know how. And so I just continued to drink, and I got into trouble. Got in trouble on the job, got in trouble at home. Everywhere I went, I got into trouble. I remember once I owed a lot of money. I wasn't paying bills when they were supposed to be. And I used to get mail in the mailbox with the big red letters on the outside. It would say, pay up or die. And so one day it occurred to me, and if you can do this, you can take this disease to the moon. It occurred to me that it was all their fault. It was all their fault. And so I walked out of my house. Whenever I think about it today, I get terribly upset. I walked out of my house, a beautiful wife, family, children. I walked out of my house to find peace of mind. I wound up living in one room. And I remember I could wander around the streets and I could pick up a few dollars to drink. People knew I was on the job, and I could pick a few dollars up here and there. And after a while, I couldn't even do that. I was sleeping in a dirty basement. And one day I came to in that basement, and I looked around. And I saw I was dirty, filthy, I hadn't bathed. And I thought to myself, what are you doing in this basement? I come from a good family. I have a relatively good education. What are you doing here? And so I did what I always did when I got into a jackpot. I was going to pray. When I was a little kid, and I guess everybody, when you're a little kid and your mother said you're going to church, you could take you to church. So I went to church, and I listened very carefully to what the preacher said. And what I heard the preacher say was God was somebody you could make a deal with. Yeah, you do this for me, and I'll do that for you. And every time I prayed and I got in a jackpot, I prayed, and lots of times I got out of that jackpot. And so I prayed in the basement, and nothing happened. At least I thought nothing happened. I know today that God was right there. God hadn't gone anywhere. There is a line somewhere. There is a point beyond which God will not permit us to endure pain. We all reach that point at some time, and when some of us reach it, we die. When some of us reach it, we find our way into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but whether we die or whether we come here, God has arranged that we don't have to drink anymore. One of my favorite writers is a man named Walter Benton. In one of his writings, he says, our time is of days and hours, and as the clock hand turns, a circle closes in upon us, and a black, timeless night sucks us in like quicksand and receives us totally, without a rain check or a parachute or a key to heaven or a last long look. The alcoholic spirals down and down and down and down, and then for some inexplicable reason, God reaches in and plucks some of us out, sets us into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Occasionally, time to time, I read the other big book. One of my favorite books is the Ecclesiastics. And the Ecclesiastics, right in their book, they say for everything there is a season and a purpose for everything under the heaven. There's a time to be born and a time to die. We spiral down and down and down, and some of us die. And some of us come here. whether we live or die, God's arranged that we don't have to suffer anymore. I think that what happened to me, and it's truly the experience of God moving in my life, in all of our lives, in very mysterious ways sometimes. I had managed to get a job driving a dump truck. And I was running dumps out on Staten Island and into the landfill. Actually, it was the same landfill they used after 9/11. And when I was driving back and forth, it was brand new. And I was on my way back from the yard, and I blacked out, and I ran into a landfill. And nothing serious happened. Police came, got me up, got the truck out of there. And they suggested I go get an x-ray, and I did. And I forgot about it. Well, the next morning, I get a call from somebody at the hospital, and they said I had to come to the hospital right away. Well, I tried to explain to this lady we had just invested in a bottle of wine, and I wasn't going anywhere. But she said, if you don't come down, we're going to send somebody out to get you. And the last thing I needed was people looking for me. So I went down there, not to make a long story longer, I had tuberculosis. And I had it so severely, they wouldn't let me go back home. They put me in an ambulance, and they shipped me out to isolation ward way out on a tip in a Staten Island place called Seaview Hospital. And I spent the next year and a half out there. And I realized that that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. And it may seem strange saying getting a serious disease like tuberculosis was a good thing, but for me it was. While you're in the hospital, you're in bed the entire time. They even take you to the bathroom in a wheelchair. So while I was there, only thing I had time to do was to think. And I look back over my life, and I saw that every single time I got into any difficulty, any time I went to jail or got lost a job or got into a fight, I was drinking or I was drunk. From the time I was a little kid, and I realized there's something wrong. And I think it was there in the hospital that the cement block up here lifted and the message went through, there's something wrong with you. It has to do with alcohol. Well, I got to tell you, nobody came running down the hall with a donut and a cup of coffee saying, we got an AA meeting over here. What happened was the supervising nurse on my job happened to be one of you sneaky people. And the day before I was to be discharged, I was sitting on the edge of the bed, and she came by, and very quiet, and I was very subdued, which is not my normal state. And she asked me what was wrong, and I told her. I was afraid. I was afraid to go back out in the street. While I was in the hospital, I was in a protected environment. I had everything I needed done for me. I knew the minute I stepped outside the door, I'd be just like Alice in Wonderland, running twice as fast to stay exactly where I was. And I told her I was afraid. And she asked the question, I guess, everybody in here gets asked one way or another. She said, do you really want help? And I said, yes, I really want help. And she arranged for me to get to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I got to tell you, the John Birch Society started on the South Shore of Staten Island. And they've got people on the South Shore of Staten Island that think the John Birch Society are liberals. The first meeting I went to was on the South Shore of Staten Island. And I knew the minute I walked into the room, there was something wrong. The first thing, there weren't any black people in there. The other thing was, this was in February. And there were guys in there wearing white shoes in the wintertime. And I said, these are some very strange people. And I was on my way out the door, and a guy came up from the other side, and he showed me this blue book. And he said, everything that you will ever need is in this book. Well, I figured my scheme in mind went right to work. When I came out the hospital, everything I owned, I carried out of there in a shopping bag, and that had a hole in it. I figured I'd read this book, and I'd figure out how to get a loan out to these people. Well, I read the book, read it from top, cover to cover, and I came back. And his name was Ellie Andrews. God bless him. He died when I was 15 years sober. I used to call him my walking stick. I said, Ellie, I can't get a loan out of this book. And he said, yes, you can. And we started. He said that what you have to do is to accept the idea that you do not have the answers, that the answers are somewhere else. And if you read this book, you possibly will get it. He used to do that all the time. He would tell me, I would tell him things like, God bless him. I would say, I can't find a job. He said, well, you used to have a job. He said, I said, I don't feel well. He said, this may be as good as you'll ever feel. He said, I can't stand. He said, well, sit down. He used to tell me on a regular basis stuff like, the three words you never want to hear an alcoholic say is, I've been thinking. He'd do that to me. He would tell me regularly, you do not have to read this book. You don't have to do these steps. You could do it when you come back. After a while, I just stopped talking. And what he said we were going to do, he said, we're going to walk through these steps and we're going to build an arch. And when that arch is completed, we're going to be able to step through into what he called the sunlight of the Spirit. And he told me that the key to the cornerstone of the arch is the first step, because it tells us what's wrong with us. We're powerless over alcohol. That's the problem. The cornerstone is the solution. The cornerstone says we come to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. So if the problem is we have no power, the solution is find the power. And then the keystone in that arch is step three. Anybody who's ever built the arch knows that all the other stones lay against the arch. And what the third step tells us, we have to turn our will and our life over to care of somebody other than ourselves. And he gives us a very simple prayer to do that. And the essence of the prayer says, remove me from the bondage of myself. In other words, get me out of the way. I do not have the power. I need to find the power. And all the other stones lay against the arch. And we started to walk down this. And we went through all the turmoil and the frustration that everybody does walking through this process. And I can't think of anybody that I know that didn't have trouble doing it. You know, we got to the fourth step, and he said, well, write down everybody that you're mad at. There wasn't enough paper. And then we had to sit down with him and walk through that to see who they were. But in all this process, what I didn't understand was that I was looking at myself. I was looking at the truth of myself in each one of them. Many years ago when I walked the beat, I used to know a man. His name was Haj Malik El-Shabazz. Many people know him as Malcolm X. And I'll never forget something that Malcolm told me once. He said, truth without love is cruel. He said that confrontation without a solution is worthless. Well, I walked in here and I had to start to look at the truth of myself. But in here we do it with love and understanding and compassion. So when I confronted the truth of myself, there was a solution. Malcolm once said to me, no one can give you power. Power is something you have to take. And I walk in here and I pick up our book and I see Bill Wilson has written that the great reality, the real power, is deep down within each and every one of us. Then he goes on to tell us how to find it. Rid yourself of all bias, think honestly, and look inside yourself diligently. And a power will emerge. And a power that emerges is awesome. Awesome. I love to see women when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We have this kind of double standard in our society. A man can go out and get drunk, fall down, roll around in the gutter, get up the next day, put on a clean shirt and tie, and walk away. Nobody thinks anything about it. But if a woman does the same thing, somehow she gets marked. Somehow there's something wrong with her. Something, there's like a demon on her shoulder that says, you have no worth. Somebody once said, can you kill the demon? No, you can't kill the demon, but you can educate him right off your shoulder. And we say to you, come to us. Let us love you until you can love yourself. And very soon, you see the change. And they begin to smile from in here and not with their teeth. And you know, God is in his heaven and all is right with the world. And so we went through this process. And I began to change. I looked at myself. I saw who I was and what I was and what had happened. And we come to a point where he lets us make a decision. Do you want to stay? Do you want to change? Are you ready to have God remove those defects? And then he told me, I thought, sure, by that time, I could take care of this. I knew a lot. I had learned a little bit about myself. But he said, you can't change anything. What you can do is set up the conditions so a change can take place. A farmer can't grow anything. He sets up the conditions. He plants the seeds. He waters the soil. He sets the conditions so a change can take place. God will make the plants grow. A doctor can't heal anybody. He sets up the conditions. He can describe the medication, diagnose the illness. He sets up the condition so the change can take place. God will make the patient well. We can't change anything. We can set the conditions so a change can take place. And when we've become ready to have God remove these defects of character, we've already set the conditions, and then all we have to do is ask. Humbly ask. And again, he's given us a very simple prayer. And the prayer says, I give myself to thee, do with me as I will. Remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you. Let me go out from here and do your will. Well, I said that prayer, and I thought I'd at the very least I'd get a halo or a pair of wings. And Ellie said, go back and read that again. And I read it again, and what it says is remove these defects of character so that I can be useful. That's the key. When I'm useful, when I do something for someone and expect nothing in return, I become well, I get better. Strange kind of dichotomy. I never would have understood that if I hadn't walked in here. And so we continued on down that path. And I came to a point where he said, you've been out here for a long time. You've heard a lot of people. He said, write that down. And I made a whole list of people. And then he said, now you have to go out and make amends to them. And I did. I did, and my whole life changed. I remember once I was speaking out in Salinas, Kansas. And at the end of the talk, the chairman was sitting where Flo was, and he says, now we'll take some questions. The guy in the audience got up and said, you know that point in the book where it says that you will be amazed before you are halfway through? I said, yeah. He said, well, how do you know when you're halfway through? I said, are you amazed? He said, no. I said, well, you ain't halfway through. It didn't occur to me that there was a lot of work that I had to do, even at that point. That it wasn't over. About the same time, my wife had developed cancer, breast cancer, and she died. And my children were in my two boys were in foster care. And I was very, very unhappy about that. And I went going to Ellie and asking him, I said, I'm going to go and get my sons back. He said, be very careful what you pray for. God wants to punish you, he'll answer your prayers. So I got my boys back. Two of them. And I spent the next 10 years raising both of them. And they're two beautiful, fine young men. And they're both police officers. And that ought to tell you something. They're both in AA. that'll tell you something else. And they went through a lot of trials and tribulations. Their mother had passed, and I had to raise them as best I could. But I had the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous with me. And they saw what I did. I remember Malcolm once said to me, we're known by our deeds. We're judged by our conscious behavior. People know what we do. They see what we do. And my kids watched me. And they began to grow. And they turned into fine young men. It wasn't easy, but we had the help of the hand of God. When I first came to AA, I had no idea what God really was. I had walked through all this process, and I still wasn't really clear on that. Didn't know what God was. And then I read in our book what Bill calls God, the great reality. God is everything. God is love, and God is life. There can be no love or life separate from God. I didn't understand that. The other thing I wasn't sure of, God wasn't out there somewhere. He was right here. All I had to do was reach in and take it out. You hear the expression around the room, we're here by the grace of God. And that's absolutely true. We are here by the grace of God. But the grace of God isn't out there. We were born with the grace of God. And our experience impacts us, and we convince ourselves that we're less than that. And as we come through this process, we find that we are really, truly perfect children of God, and we always will be. So we went through this process, and we came to this point, and I finally got my children back. And one day I was at a meeting of my group, and I went out to the restroom, and I came back, and I was a GSR. I didn't know what a GSR was. Ellie said, not to worry. Gave me a service manual. I guarantee anytime you can't sleep at night, get a service manual. So I started walking my way through this service structure. I got elected. I was the first district committee member in Staten Island, the first one ever. We only had seven groups in the whole of Staten Island. And then one day, my service sponsor, who was actually secretary to Bill for quite a while, said that there's a vacancy on the AA World Services Corporate Board. Put your resume in. Well, I really did not want to do it, but if you knew Jackie Solomon, you don't argue with her. So I did. Next thing I knew, I was director on the World Services Corporate Board. In case anybody doesn't know it, that's where your money goes. They do all the publishing, translation, all the rest of it. And at one point, I was chairman of the board, me, drunk like me, handling all your money. So for 4 years, I was a World Services. And then I was elected as a trustee on the board of trustees of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had the rare experience of traveling around the world and seeing Alcoholics Anonymous in many, many places. I've traveled to many. I remember once I had gone up to a place in Scotland, a place called Glasgow, at the International. And I remember when I got into Glasgow, my host at the time was a man named Ray Magruder, and he owned two bars, two lounges, and he owned a Rolls Royce. And he called me up and asked if I wanted to go on a 12-step call, and I'll never forget that. I said, yeah, sure. Went on a 12-step call with him, and it turns out to be the person we were 12-stepping was a member of Parliament. I mean, it was unbelievable. Guy lived in this fantastic mansion. We walk inside, he was crawling around the floor, drunk as a skunk. I got to tell you, they puked just like we do. We gathered this guy up and carried him with us for about a week. We took him down to Blackpool, England. I'm not sure if the guy is sober today or not, but it was one of the most extraordinary experiences I ever had. And I traveled around and I saw instances like that. We had a regional forum, and it was at the time the Berlin Wall came down, and we were translating our book into all the Eastern Bloc countries, Lithuania, Romania, Czechoslovakia. And we were all excited and very happy. And the regional trustee at the time asked, was there any questions? And the guy in the back stood up and he said, how many of our books have been translated into the African language of Swahili? It got as quiet there as it did in here, because there weren't any. But to give you a sense of the dedication of our staff in New York in the General Service Office, we had been corresponding with a priest in Kenya, and he had translated the big book. And he sent us his translation, and we edited it. And not to make a long story longer, within 6 months, we had the book of Alcoholics Anonymous in Swahili. And what was really amazing, the guy that asked his name was Abongo. He was from Kenya. He was an exchange student. And he was having his 10th anniversary. And he asked me to speak for him. So I went and spoke at his 10th anniversary, and I gave him the first book of Alcoholics Anonymous in Swahili. It was extraordinary. We have... I remember when the Russians came to New York, because nobody in Russia would go to AA meetings. And nobody couldn't figure it out. AA was thriving in Finland, Poland, but they wouldn't go to AA meetings in Russia. So the Russians came over and tried to figure out why. And what the problem was that in every AA meeting, they had a KGB person in the room, and nobody showed up. So we told them, take the KGB man, and they did. And AA started to thrive in Russia. And stories like that I had gone through for years and years and years. And I think that we can see the real effect of that. I had the extraordinary privilege of knowing Lois Wilson. I got to know Lois. I was also really pleased to see so many Al-Anons in here. Really. I love Al-Anon. Did you know Al-Anons have slips? That fleeting moment of compassion. I don't want none of your Al-Anons throwing nothing up here. But we begin to see the extraordinary breadth and scope of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a panel this afternoon, and we talked about spirituality is not a theory. And we can see the benefits of the spiritual context of Alcoholics Anonymous and everything that we do. We see how it helps us in our daily lives. We see how we reach out to help other people. I loved it when I saw the Alateens yesterday. They were just, weren't they beautiful? They brought a special message to us, because they're going to grow into successful, healthy people, and they're going to be able to carry our message. Our message is extraordinary. We have the ability to talk to another sick person and have them hear what we say. And so Alcoholics Anonymous has become most of my life. What I do now is I teach a class in Baltimore. I teach a class of ex-offenders, men coming out of prison, transitioning back into the community. And what I've done is I've formulated a series of lectures based on our principles. And they've been working. We looked at ourselves. We look at the anger. We learn how to make decisions. We can see that our experiences are responsible for the way we act. And the only thing that we can do is change the way we think. Exactly what we do here. And it's been very, very successful. We've had people come from other states to see our program at work. The other thing I think that's really important, I've been boxing for a very long time. When I was a little kid, I started. I was mean, so my mother took me in a gym and made me learn how to do something other than get in trouble in the street. So I started boxing, and as I move around the country in various activities, I started boxing gyms. I took a couple of kids to the Olympics in 96 in Atlanta. Got a couple already getting ready to go to the Nationals now. And what I found is that when you begin to get young people involved and committed, they don't get into other negative activities. And that's been working tremendously. Not only do we have young boys, we have young girls. And they learn the same kinds of principles that we learn. None of that would have been possible if I hadn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I learned that the great reality, the real power, is deep down within each and every one of us. That I have a way, a method of reaching in and taking that power out. And if I can do good with that power, I get better. It's a very simple concept, but it's not easy all the time. And so I've done that for as long as I can. I've been sober as long as I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the grace of God, I'm going to continue to do it. In 1980, I was spoke at Bill W.'s anniversary at the Hilton in New York. And Lois always is there. Lois is always at the Bill's anniversary. And upstairs over the edge, over the stage in the Hilton, there's a little reception room. And I was early, and I walked in the reception room, and Lois was sitting there by herself. And I sat down, and I talked to Lois on many occasions. And we always talked. She's a beautiful lady, tiny lady, but she could have her voice, you could resonate it, as small as she was. In any event, we sat and we talked for quite a while. And I remember her telling me the story about the time that Bill Wilson met with some Arabic AAs, had come to AA. And when Arabs meet you, one of the things they say is, that in Arabic, we salute you and we thank you for your life. And when they met Bill, that's what they said to him. We salute you. And we thank you for their lives. And what Lois says is that they had taken our message, the message that Bill wrote, the message that we passed on and on and on, and they put it into their lives, and they were saved as a result of it. And so when they saw Bill, they said, we salute you, and we thank you for your life. Every time I come to a gathering like we have here tonight, and I look around and see the breadth and scope and the success of the people who come here and the potential for carrying this message on and on and on. And that's the real value that we have here, that we can make things better. I think of that. I think of what the Arabs said to Bill. And so I say to you, each and every one of you tonight, you are the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's your lives. It's your world. So I salute you, and I thank you for your life.